Welcome to Pop Trouble, the roots of all things cinema. We go into the cinematic history to discover movies that help influence, shape, and entertain the moviegoers. We look to answer the number one question we get asked as movie critics: what movie should I watch? In each episode, we will embark on one or two films from our countdown of the top 100 films that all moviegoers should watch. We're going to jump into movie number 96, which is The Apartment.
We went to bat for you, and now you won't play ball with us.
Well, after all, it's my apartment. It's private property. It's not a public playground.
All right, so you got yourself a girl. That's okay with us, but not every night in the week.
How selfish can you get? Last week, I had to borrow my nephew's car and take Sylvia to a drive-in in Jersey. I'm too old for that sort of thing. I mean, in the Volkswagen.
I sympathize with your problem. Believe me, I'm very sorry.
You'll be a lot sorrier before we're through with you.
Are you threatening me?
Listen, Baxter, we made you and we can break you.
So The Apartment is about a man named C.C. Baxter, played by Jack Lemmon. It's about him working at a life insurance company, and it's finding a way to get involved with his executives and rise throughout the ranks. But through this, as a single man who's trying to find a purpose in life and to be successful in business, he gets entangled with, I would say, other executives who start abusing his apartment. And it only complicates things in this romantic comedy. I don't even know if it's a romantic comedy.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I call it that either.
It's more like a romantic drama, I would almost say. It's, that is directed by Billy Wilder and also written by Billy Wilder. So it is, I think, one of those films that we're going to start getting into right now. It's kind of an interesting film because for me, it's like, especially in nowadays in 2019, we talk about, the Me Too movement, which is big and prevalent and honestly is necessary about the respect of women. And you watch a film like this and you see the lack of respect that women have. But then I also thought about it. I've seen this film several times. The one thing I saw in this film too was the abuse that women got, but the same as the abuse that men got too. If you were lower than the execs, they were going to take advantage of you like they did C.C. Baxter, or with even Shirley MacLaine, who's in it, named Fran. You know, it was you saw the abuse of power over, I guess you'd say, the people that worked for them or the people beneath, you know.
Yeah, and this was a lot of movie to unpack. I was very surprised by that.
Yeah. But it was interesting, though. It really did address those issues in the same time. And that's what this time when I saw that I didn't realize was how much it did talk about the abuse and the consequences of having affairs and trying to succeed in business, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
All the wrong ways. So was this the first time you saw this film, right?
Yeah. So this is one of those movies that's been in my blind spot for the longest time. It's, you know, one of those titles that I'd heard, but I didn't know much about the actual plot. I knew that Jack Lemmon was in it and Shirley MacLaine, and that was enough to get me interested. But so I was really surprised over, you know, the first half. I was like, oh, you know, this is, you know, it's kind of a fun romantic comedy. I like the setup. And then about halfway through, it gets flipped on its head and turns into something way different.
Yeah. And that's what I loved about the film was it wasn't what I thought. Once you get halfway through, all of a sudden it does take a hard twist to a very serious topic. And I think this is where, you know, and I'm kind of jumping to how this movie affected pop culture was because it did come to the effect of the seriousness of suicide. And I think it's okay to talk about that. First, I think I want to, it's to me was the big thing. And without getting into what, but you kind of see C.C. Baxter, he tells a story in there about his attempt and you almost don't believe him. I don't know. When you saw, I didn't believe it when I first saw it. I thought he was just joking around trying to
Yeah, I kind of thought so too. And I was like, yeah.
But then when you see the actual gun, you're like, oh crap. He wasn't kidding near the end. And I thought that was kind of an interesting prop that Wilder put into the film was all of a sudden you realize, yeah, he was serious and he wasn't lying. He was actually telling the truth.
Oh, yeah. This movie is not afraid to go there.
And then the whole thing about allowing, to me, it was the also thing was the whole thing about allowing to be used. But even though he didn't like it, he knew that it was his way. If he was going to succeed in that business,
yeah,
it was almost kind of was got to the point where he's being blackmailed in a way.
He's definitely one of those people that you see getting stepped on through the whole movie.
One of the things that really came out to me about this film was when you see the beginning of the film, you hear him giving all this data of how many people work in this, live in the city, how many work at this office, you know, and he's very analytical. So I started thinking when you start seeing this movie, you almost have to see it in an analytical view at first to kind of understand why he was in the position he was, because if you look at the numbers, it's the only way that he was going to be able to move forward, or he was going to be, you know, out of a job, essentially.
Yeah.
That's the way that I was looking at it anyways. So tell me, what did you see any reviews on this film or?
Yeah. So I wanted to take a look at what critics thought then.
Yeah.
And I was surprised because I had a few talks with Amy, the wife lady, about this movie. Because so we watched it together last night and we both had a few opinions on the moral stance of movies then compared to now and stuff like that. So I was curious what a female critic would think of the movie in 1960.
Okay.
So I found an article by Wanda Hale of the New York Daily News from 1960. And she gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars. And she said, "The Apartment is a departure from Mr. Wilder, the director. A bold stroke even for him. His humor is devastating, stripping the philanderers and their eager consorts of all their dignity." And I thought that was a really cool statement right there.
It was a bold, this movie, he makes a bold statement, I believe, in this film about, you know, women are not objects. And that's kind of what I took from it.
Hmm.
And it was because
I was kind of torn on if that's what I got from it or not. I was like, I feel like it's trying to get there, but I wasn't sure if it completely succeeded.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that because I was seeing some reviews. I mean, they were talking about kind of where I was getting. But then I saw some that were saying that they didn't feel like they got to that point where they could feel sympathy for any of the characters. And I honestly, for me, I felt like you have to kind of almost go back in time, not like we're talking about Back in the Future, but if you have to kind of go back in time and see what you're dealing with and where they're trying to get is different from nowadays. And
I had to
like look at, okay, obviously this is kind of what people were not like. I think it was obviously exaggerated because it was almost reminding me of Wolf of Wall Street when they're at their Christmas party, but but you almost had to look at the 1950s. What was it like in the 1950s? And that he wanted to make a statement that I felt was never made in that type of era or in movies at that time, and especially mainstream movies.
And this is a movie that came out right on the cusp of women's rights movement.
Yeah.
1960. It's right around that time. And you could see how Hollywood was starting to change a little bit already. Like, just the subject matter of this movie is stuff that I don't think you'd see in a lot of movies from before that.
No. Did you realize, too, that one thing, it was kind of an interesting tidbit about it was, so when the movie was being filmed, Billy Wilder did not give Shirley MacLaine the whole script.
Really?
He only gave her 40 pages of the script because he didn't want her to know how the story would turn out.
Ah, that is interesting. Well, if that was some kind of ploy to get a good performance out of her, I would say he succeeded.
Oh, I agree 100%. And so for me, it's like if he was doing something like that, obviously he is really trying to hone the point down. I mean, at least at that time, you know, and the other thing I'll tell you, an interesting fact that I found was that the studio wanted, you know, the Dr. Dreyfus, the person they wanted to be Dr. Dreyfus was Groucho Marx.
Really?
And he said, no. He's like, we're going to have, you know, Jack Crushen, who he was like actually the second choice of Jack Lemmon. And he actually got nominated for Best Supporting Actor because I thought he did a phenomenal job as the doctor. He deserved it. Yeah.
I don't know if this was my introduction to him, but I was blown away by him in this movie. I thought he was one of the most standout roles.
Oh, I agree, like, 100%.
I loved him. I like every time he was in a scene, I was like, yeah, I love this guy.
He brought the flavor to the movie. You kind of started seeing the neighbor, you know? you know, like that cared. And it was just kind of interesting. I've been wanting to see more movies that he's been in, and I started looking. I mean, I guess he's been in a lot of TV series. I guess especially during that time, you definitely see a lot these actors that do jump from TV to some to movies, but not too often. But man, I wish there was more movies that I could find that he was in.
Yeah, I actually kind of want to go out of my way to see what else he's done.
He was in War of the Worlds in 1953.
Oh, okay.
And he was in this one I've never heard of it. It's called Lover Come Back in 1961.
Okay, heard of it, never seen it.
Okay, and then the last one I was going to mention was The Angry Red Planet. So I have not seen that one either.
Sounds like my kind of movie.
It sounds like my kind of movie, too.
Well, yeah, speaking of performances, Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine. So this was one of the few movies I'd seen a young Jack Lemmon in. He's got this cadence about him that wasn't like your typical leading man from that time.
No.
Like, I thought he was very believable. And, like, he didn't have that kind of look that you'd see from, you know, your romantic comedy lead.
Yeah, exactly. One thing that is kind of add to that was you almost saw it was easy to see that contrast, especially in this film, because Fred McMurray, who was Jeff Sheldrick, not doctor, but the exec of the company. Yeah. You saw with the leading man, and I just was like, man, it's a jerk compared to Jack, you know? And
because he was the lead in, was it Double Indemnity, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I've seen. I really like that movie, too.
Yeah, that's a really good movie. And, yeah, so, I mean, to see him come and play this not a guy that you just don't want anything good to have to do. Yeah.
He's slimy.
Yes.
Just about every guy in Baxter's office is just the worst.
Which is kind of funny because I thought he did an awesome job playing that type of role. And of course, when I first saw Fred McMurray was actually as absent-minded professor, even though that came out a year after. I mean, I was born later on, obviously. And so I was introduced to him when he with that movie. And then seeing him in The Apartment, it's like such a contrast.
Oh, must mean he's a good actor.
Yes, he is.
He did a good job making me dislike him in this movie. That is for sure.
But I'll tell you,
the lack of compassion he has for the things that he causes to happen is just cringy.
The Jack Lemmon, though, we'll get into, you know, not to give it away, but obviously there's another film we'll talk about down the road, which is Some Like It Hot. That was how I was introduced to Jack Lemmon. And when I saw that, you know, seeing The Apartment, I was like, you know who he reminds me of, actually, and I don't know why I'm saying this, but he looks like Dave Matthews from Dave Matthews Band.
Yeah, he totally does. Yeah, that's just not that leading man kind of look, but I like that.
No, but he was so good.
Yeah. I really enjoyed him in this movie. I knew him as one of the two grumpy old men in Grumpy Old Men.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
The one that's not Walter Matthau. That's always been Jack Lemmon for me. So seeing how, like, a younger performance of his, like, he's so energetic and spry in this movie.
Yeah.
He had a lot of charm. Even though, like, he does some morally ambiguous stuff to attain what he's trying to get, but he's got enough charisma that he makes him likable despite some of the more questionable things that he does.
Yeah.
Like, he's still kind of empathetic.
Yeah. I mean, and that was one of the things that I liked about this film too, The Apartment, was that he wasn't a saint by all means, but he was, how do I want to say it? You could start seeing that he started realizing the abuse. And obviously, at the end of the film, without giving that away, you see that he finally realizes the difference between work life and human life, I guess. I don't know if that makes sense. Humanity.
Learns to be a mensch.
Yeah, a mensch.
Yeah. Love that line.
That line, I was trying to remember that line, the word mensch, for so long, because I love that now. I don't know, the first time I ever heard mensch, I was like, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But after this film, it's a great thing.
Oh, yeah.
You got to be a man. So
it's Shirley MacLaine. That was another case where this came out during a time where a lot of the romantic interest of a lead male in movies from like the late 50s or any time in the 50s was kind of ditzy a lot of the time. And she was not ditzy.
No.
She was very feisty. Like she had a spark to her.
And that was one thing that I really enjoyed about her performance was she actually stood her ground. I mean, I think she realized that she had a fling going, but you could see that's the one thing that added on the slime onto Fred's character was you started seeing how he was manipulating her, that he was going to leave his wife, that he was going to, you know, go after her and they were going to get married. And it was until the secretary, I believe, that finally broke it to her saying, hey, look at, he said the same thing to this woman. And then she had the guts to know that, yeah, this isn't going to happen. You know, she didn't just fall back. And when he said, oh, no, I'm saying it for real. No, she had a backbone. And I love that. It was like she showed strength in her character that you didn't see it. I didn't feel like I've seen too often, even especially during that time.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree more. Even movies like On the Waterfront, which I loved. It seemed like it was going that direction, but they ended up kind of weakening the female lead in that movie by the end. This movie did cover some new ground, I feel like.
Yeah, and you know, I know this didn't inspire James Cameron, but it reminded me of James Cameron films. After I watched it, I started thinking, you know, because Billy Wilder really had, one of the things I do like is he does usually have strong female roles in his film, even in Ben-Hur. I loved this, you know, the strong roles that he gives women. And I was thinking of another director who else does that. And the one that came to mind was James Cameron, where you see in Terminator and you see in T2, and then you see in Avatar, you got strong female role. Even in Titanic, for crying out loud, Kate Winslet was a strong female character. And so it was kind of cool to see that I could almost compare Billy Wilder with James Cameron with the roles that they give women.
Yeah, that's something I've always admired about James Cameron's movies, too. He'd had some complaints about Wonder Woman when that came out, because he was saying that, he's like, you know, she's an empowering leading female character, but he feels like they sexualized her or that they were saying, oh, you have to be basically a supermodel to be a hero. Well, he tried to have his female leads a little more. They're not like overly manly characters.
They show some grittiness and some lack of fear, I guess, in their roles. I mean, or even in the Alien, you know.
Yeah, he never tried to sexualize his female leads.
No. But, you know, what I have to say, though, I couldn't see myself because I am definitely not in shape. I could not be, you know, if I was you know, a lot of these action roles, they have to be a little bit fit, you'd think.
Yep.
Or else I'd be eaten by some alien.
Oh, I would too.
Or some flower in was it Pandora in Avatar?
Pandora. Yeah, so, I wonder when we're getting that sequel.
Yeah, no kidding. I know he's been working on it. I did finally see, I know I'm kind of digressing, but I finally saw that one that he wrote that just came out.
Alita?
Alita, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, what'd you think of that?
I enjoyed it, but the script was pretty... I had a hard time with the script a little bit. I love the visuals in it, but the script is killing me.
Oh, yeah. I could not stand the lead teenage boy in it. I thought he was awful.
It reminded me of, like, Rufio, but...
Yeah, like, this is one of those cases where you have, like, an old writer trying to write hip teenage characters.
Yes! That's what I was thinking when I saw it.
It was cringy.
Oh. It was funny, though. Jasmine, my daughter, she was, like, she actually liked it a lot. And I'm like, all right, but I guess either I'm getting old or it's just sign of the times of what teenagers like. But I was like, you know, this does not sound like the teenagers I know today.
No. It's like an alien writing human dialogue, basing it on books about how to act like a human. Yes. It's like, it's not very believable.
Well, that's awesome. Well, kind of going back to the apartment. How do we get to Alita from?
Oh, no idea. Talking about James Cameron.
That's awesome. No, I love it. I love it. But one of the things that was kind of interesting about this film was, so it was nominated for, let me see here, 10 Academy Awards. And it won for Best Picture.
Yeah.
It won for Best Director, Best Screenplay, Editing, and Art Direction. But I was surprised that Jack Lemmon didn't win, or, you know, Shirley MacLaine didn't win, or, you know,
they dropped.
No, they were nominated, but they didn't win. Or Jack Crucian, I'm probably butchering his name, as Dr. Dreyfus, he was nominated for Supporting Actor. So, but the movie at that time did $24.6 million. Interesting thing, this was the last black and white film that won until Schindler's List.
Oh, wow. Yeah, 1960 was a little late for a movie to be released in black and white.
Now, if you're saying because there's a red jacket in Schindler's List, then I guess the next one would be The Artist. But, yeah. I mean, think about that timeline. I mean, that a black and white feature won, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
Did you ever see The Artist?
I did.
Okay, I haven't. I never saw The Artist.
No, it's all right. It was all right. It is interesting, though. Have you seen Some Like It Hot?
I have not.
So it is one of it's one of those films I laughed so hard throughout the whole film, to the beginning to the end. And this was the film, ironically, that Billy Wilder did. He did The Apartment after Some Like It Hot. So it's kind of like you're kind of seeing a different type of vibe from Billy Wilder, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I've read, like, widely throughout the reviews, is this is something completely new for him.
Yeah, and he actually wrote C.C. Baxter for Jack Lemmon while they were writing the screenplay, which I thought was, that's got to be a huge compliment to any actor to have a movie written for you.
Oh, yeah, especially by somebody like Billy Wilder.
Yeah, now,
I didn't realize that he was known so much for writing as he was for direction, because I know of a lot of the movies that he's directed, you know, by name. But I didn't realize how many things he'd actually written. He's got something like 70 something writing credits.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, that guy, he was an icon. And if we have legends, he should be, or if we had like a Mount Rushmore of directors, and or just even, you know, people that made a huge indent in influence in film.
Yeah.
Like, I think Billy Wilder would be like one of those guys.
Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, Sabrina, Ocean's Some Like 11. It Hot, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He wrote Ocean's 11.
Yeah. So, I mean, just he's been in a ton of, he's written a lot, like you said, but he's, you know.
Yeah. And this movie did have noticeably good direction. And it did win the Oscar for set design, right?
It won for art direction. It didn't win for sound mixing or cinematography, were the other ones. But it did win for screenplay, editing, director, which he deservedly should win.
Oh, absolutely. And, like, from the opening couple of shots, just, like, inside that building is, like, inside the work building, that was some phenomenal direction.
I mean, I don't know. I was just thinking about, how do you make a film about a guy who's lending his apartment out? And we never knew what he got in return. That's except what his, obviously what he was getting paid, you know.
Yeah.
Promotion.
Yeah, just promises of promotions. Real quick. So Amy found this, because we both did a little bit of research on this movie after we watched it, because we were kind of we were intrigued by it. Yeah. And she found this little piece about Shirley MacLaine's performance from a review from Variety that she wanted me to read.
Okay.
Because I guess she strongly agreed with this. So it says, Miss MacLaine, again in pixie hairdo, is a prize that's consistent with the fight being waged for her affections. Her ability to play it broad where it should be broad, subtle where it must be subtle, enables the actress to affect reality and yet do so much more. Rather than a single human being, Miss MacLaine symbolizes the universal prey of convincing, conniving married men within the glass walls of commerce. And I was like, All right. I could have said it better myself.
Yeah, no kidding, man. Wow. So what was Amy's thoughts about the film?
She was not a fan. She thought that it was a blatant product of its time as far as kind of sexism goes.
Yeah, but you kind of have to, when you see films like that, you kind of have to remember it was of that time, you know, and it's those are the things where the story where you get from it, from watching it, too.
Yeah. Yeah. To appreciate a movie like this one as much as it's been appreciated over the years means having to come to terms with the sensibilities of the time that it was made.
Right.
And that can be difficult to look at through a modern lens.
Though it also tells me, too, that even back then, you know, you always hear about how great it was in the USA. I don't know. I always hear from at least my parents how good it was back then, you know. Maybe because they're thinking of the Beatles, but anyways, but you really do see that there was a lot of things that they needed to work on even back in their time. And
you see a little bit behind the curtains of the time and you're like, okay.
But you know what? That's what's so great about this film. This is what I really enjoyed about it was you see that. You see it captured on camera. Because how easy would it be to take that out or get rid of this film and then you see a cycle return? You see what I mean?
Yep.
It's kind of like, why do you make Schindler's List? Do you make it because it's fun? No. You make it so people remember. You make it so that we have a snapshot in time of what happens and then you don't forget. You remind yourself of, you know, this is how it was, but can it be that way now? No. You know, and it's great to even measure from what happened then to what happens now. You know, I manage, right, you know, quite a few people. And you see, like, the constructs of even to what I can say in an interview or what can I say to an employee, what kind of process I have to go through, what kind of training we all have to go through. If we do this, what's the consequence of doing that? What kind of, and you start seeing that nowadays, why it's constructed that way. When back in 1950s, that wasn't there, you know, you know, and at the same time, and one of the things that Elvia brought to it was, it's surprising to see that a lot of those things though still happen today.
Oh, unfortunately. Absolutely.
That's just kind of my two cents on that. So when we talk about, we're kind of answering our next question about pop culture and how, you know, how this movie could affect pop culture. I think it brings everything out of the shadows.
Like you were saying earlier, there's a few similarities between this and the show Mad Men. And yes. I don't think that was accidental on that show's part. Like, there's a crazy amount of similarity. So, like, even just between, like, the work environment in the movie, even a character being named Miss Olson, working as a secretary within the building.
Yeah.
You know, that show takes place, I think, the same year that this movie was shot.
Yeah. In fact, they were saying that I was reading something where they did publicly say that the apartment did influence Mad Men. So it was an actual.
It does make sense. And that also gets into a lot of kind of conniving aspects of the business world.
Yeah.
And the effects that has on the other people in their lives. So watching this movie, I was thinking, wow, this is Mad Men the movie.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. No, and that's one of the things that's kind of fun about TV shows that we're starting to see now is that even like Mad Men, the series, where you're starting, instead of having a 2 to 3 hour movie, you're able to tell a story in like 8 hours just done by 1 hour episodes. You know, and so we're starting to see more and more of that now than we have ever before in TV.
Definitely. Who would have ever thought we'd get to this point in TV? Or you'll have some shows that are better than most movies that come out in a year, which is, I think, pretty amazing.
So the other thing that, again, we kind of talked earlier about was that I thought was suicide awareness.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of an interesting thing that was brought up. And I was trying to remember a film before that talks about it. I mean, the only thing I could think of was Romeo and Juliet, but it was more of just a bad decision on Juliet's part to take some poison.
Yeah, I don't think Romeo and Juliet quite got into the psychology and
no, they were doing it for different reasons.
Yeah,
and but it was something that really for me kind of the way that they addressed in this film was sobering. It was something that you just didn't think about till it was actually happening. And you think about in your own life, like, I don't know, I always worry about this because I've had clients that I've heard that have committed suicide. And it's tough to, it, for me, only knowing them through profession, through professionally, it's tough on me to even see that and why they would make that decision. And, you know, I'm glad that there is a film that does explore the causes and the you know, that this is a serious thing that we should always be aware of. So,
absolutely.
Even at the end of the film, and without giving it away, they even bring it up, you know, one more time. I don't know if you realize that, but I don't want to, like, it's the one with the poppy noise. That's all I'm going to say at the end.
Oh, yeah.
And she freaked out. That's all I want to say.
I freaked out.
Yeah, because she was like, what the, you know, like, could you imagine if the movie ended that way? It would have been like.
I think that was another reason Amy didn't like the movie. She was like, oh, is this some kind of joke? Because,
you know. It showed it. I think it finally, for me, it wasn't a joke. It was more of an awareness that somebody actually loved the guy.
Because
if you think about it, he always played, Jack Lemmon's character always played the guy who was forgotten, the guy who was used. He was like the tool, I guess you would say, for a lot of these things to happen. But he felt like nobody cared about him at all, I think, throughout the whole film. I mean, even his love interest in the Shirley MacLaine, when he's going to the movie to the Music Man and she doesn't show up. I don't think he ever felt like somebody cared about him. He always cared about everybody else, but nobody cared about him. And I think that's what I got at the end of the film, was somebody cared about him. We saw that.
That is a nice light to look under. This is one of those movies that I want to watch a second time because there is a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
And that was, I was kind of unprepared for that going into it. Like I was kind of expecting something like a Cary Grant comedy.
Yeah. Like Philadelphia, baby
kind of stuff.
Philadelphia Story or something like that. Yeah. But that's what I love the film. This is why I love it that much. And this is why it's in the top 100 is because I do feel like it does influence that film can be told, but truth and honesty through a good time can be also told. Because, you know, honestly, I think that's one of the things before I even was really into even classic films, I always had a hard time with black and white films because I was like, okay, here we go. Here's the same story. It's like watching the Hallmark Channel during the Christmas season. You knew what the ending is going to be. You knew what was going to happen. But when you start seeing movies like this, like Billy Wilder, and you start seeing like, holy cow, no. You're going to be getting some twists and turns, or even Sunset Boulevard or Double Indemnity. You start seeing these black and white films. Like, to me, like, if you try to remake them, it's not going to be the same effect as what these films that are raw, especially at that time, was bringing.
You don't have too many directors who made the black and white of the film look black and white on purpose. Like, this is a gorgeous looking movie in black and white.
Yeah.
And you feel like he really used that to his benefit.
So let me ask you this. Do you think there's a different style of the film in black and white versus color?
I feel like for a movie like this, because this takes place during the holiday season.
Yeah.
And it gets into such grim territory that I don't think having it in color would pull off the same effect. Because you're seeing the holidays under a different light, like from the people who are kind of downtrodden, like it's a miserable time of year for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so dark and just,
yeah,
it's like I feel like it has this aggressively dark tone over the second half that's kind of mirrored in how much of it's set in the shadows.
And in fact, you're right. And I think this film can only be in black and white if you think about it. You know, if you think about the term black and white or what is the metaphor of black and white? You know, you start realizing that in the second half of the film that, you know, because color was out during that time, I believe.
Oh, yeah. It had been around for a little bit. I would assume that you'd say that this is rewatchable.
Yeah. To me, it is. I've seen this film, I would say, I try to watch it maybe once every couple years. I like to watch it mainly because I love Jack Lemmon as in this film, just a young Jack Lemmon. I just love the change you see in him from being a guy that can be pushed around to being a guy that can stand up for himself. I don't know. It's just one of those things that I love in stories that I think even us as moviegoers, we tend to forget that there are, that sometimes movies are trying to teach us that. And I love a good female, that the strong female role. I love, you see the villainy of the film in the grays and the gray areas of this, the work environment that they were in.
Yes.
You know, so I love rewatching this film. I think it is rewatchable. I think that I can go back and watch this film, especially it always brings great perspective in, to me, especially being in business. So what about you?
I would say it's rewatchable, especially for the performances and all the different themes that you have go, like flowing throughout it. I do think that there are some things in it that I got a little bugged by, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, by the end, Shirley MacLaine's character, I keep just calling her that because I can't pronounce her character's name. Fran Kubelik.
Yeah.
By the end, I do wish that or she'd come to terms with the happiness in her life on, you know, in her own way. But I feel like it's saying that she has to find the right man in order to be happy. And I don't know.
Oh, I get what you're saying there. Yeah. So in other words, just she kind of wished that she kind of went more independent than.
Yeah, because I feel like that does kind of hurt the kind of feminist message that I was kind of getting from the movie up to that point.
Yeah.
But again, it was at least a move in the right direction as far as strong female leads. But beyond that, I would say the movie is very rewatchable. I was very surprised by it. And I think there's a reason the first half of the movie feels so fun and bubbly compared to the second half. It's because that first half is focusing on, you know, climbing the ladder, you know, getting to the top. But then the second half is focusing on the people who are stepped on to get to that point.
Yeah.
And how miserable the actions of the people at the top are making people below them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Makes sense. That's great. So, you know, is there any, so what else, I guess we'll get into that in our final thoughts, but I was before that, I kind of think we kind of went over what this movie teaches us today. I really do think that, I think we kind of covered a lot of that, but I think the one thing I want to add to it is, when people go back to when we go back to watch classic movies, I always strongly encourage, think about how it was during that time and measure it to now. We do get to see a difference in, you think about what they also went through movies. What was that? And I'm trying to remember the name of the law that they had where there are certain things they could not film or couldn't get approval, I guess, if it had certain.
The Hays Code.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, I don't know when the Hays Code ended, but you start seeing how films had to be, you know, they were through scrutiny at that time to even now, I guess you would say, you know.
Yeah, I think it was around the early 60s that the Hays Code ended.
But this is a film that I think definitely kind of danced around the Hays Code.
Yeah, I was very curious about that. I was like, okay, because this, I don't believe the Hays Code had ended at this point. And, you know, some of the rules of the Hays Code were if you commit adultery in a movie, you need to be made the villain or something like that. Or you can't have a happy ever after. But this movie, it did kind of dance around that. Like, it was bending some rules.
It was, I just looked it up. It ended in 1952.
Oh, wow. Okay. Way earlier than I thought. Never mind.
Yeah. And it says, according to what I'm reading, it says that it ended it was actually went to the Supreme Court. Because the Hays Code was declared unconstitutional. It was keeping, according to this, it was saying censorship system that saw movies as business, pure and simple, kept Hollywood on a short leash until 1952. So that's kind of interesting because it reminded me of kind of like the whole thing with rock and roll and the whole censorship that they wanted to impose, I think, in the 80s.
Yeah.
On censorship. And then they brought in John Denver thinking that he's going to be on the side of censorship. And then the fact that he wasn't because they deemed his song Colorado Rocky Mountain High was censored on some station because they thought it was all about doing marijuana or something like that, getting high, when it wasn't, had nothing to do with that at all. It actually really irritated John Denver. So, you know, it's kind of
interesting. John Denver.
Don't mess with the Denver.
Don't mess with the D-man.
Hey, and Kingsman, the guy that sang John Denver's song?
Oh, yeah.
Strong.
Mark Strong, yeah.
Mark Strong, yeah.
That's like my favorite part of that movie.
So John Denver, man, he's almost like the Chuck Norris of folk music.
Yeah, he is.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, I could just picture John Denver in the courtrooms in the 80s with Twisted Sister.
Well, I'm sure Twisted Sister was twisting in their chair when they saw him too, thinking, oh, great. What is he going to do?
I love Twisted Sister.
I do too. They're great.
From the apartment to Twisted Sister.
Yes. Man, Alita, Twisted Sister, John Denver.
See the apartment. Got it all.
It's got it all, man. That's right.
Jack Lemmon. D. Snyder.
So that's great. That's awesome. Billy Wilder.
Billy Wilder would be turning in his grave. I thought this movie was good stuff.
Yeah. So do you want to give your final thoughts or?
I think I pretty much already inadvertently gave my final thoughts when I was talking about what the movie could teach us today. Yeah. Kind of goes with the movie and showing how ignoring the people below you when you're trying to rise to the top can cause some damage. Just be a decent human being is the simplest way I can think of putting it.
Yeah, I know we kind of gave our thoughts throughout this whole podcast, but I think the one thing I want to add to it was, I was thinking about this, was it really taught about karma as well in this film. And, you know, I was thinking about the ending when you were just telling me about the ending. I don't know if he actually got the girl at the end. I was just thinking about that. Think about it. She went back to play cards, but it didn't mean that they were together. It just meant that they were friends to me. We don't know. And that's the beauty of the ending. We may think that they got together, but did they really? I don't know. We don't know that.
Very good point. Okay.
Well, that's what I love about films. You can see things in different perspectives. And you can always see, I don't know, because at first I thought the same thing, but then I kind of was, and I don't mean to be spiritual right now, but the only reason why I was thinking that was, I was just talking to a buddy of mine. We were talking about, anyways, I'll tell this anyway. So in the New Testament, you have Jesus that, you know, you have the Pharisees saying, hey, here's an adulteress, you know, and he said, what are you going to do? She's supposed to be stoned. And he says, he who is cast, something along the lines like he who has not sinned can throw the first stone. And of course, they all have sinned, so they all left, and he just told her to sin no more. He never forgave her. He just told her not to sin anymore. So sometimes where I'm kind of coming back to this, again, we've really gone to a range, is sometimes I look at a film and I think of it as a certain way of, oh, they're together. But realistically, just go back and maybe those two, that couple, maybe they're not a couple, but they had a similar experience, and it was just a way to kind of, you know, finish up their friendship. I don't know. You don't know what was the ending. I mean, who knows what ended up for those two. But they both.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Because that does change how I think about the ending quite a bit.
So I'm not trying to defend the film at all. It does have things that kind of bother me. When I heard, and the only reason why I say his first name, Jeff McCarthy, Jeff Sheldrake. The one thing I remember at the one he said one thing, and I was like, what? He sounds like he's coming from like another movie when he said, you dig? Do you remember that at the end?
I remember that.
It's like, you dig? I'm like, he was so professional, and then I was so out of character. So, I mean, there were certain parts I was like, come on, you know, or, you know, it's, you know, the secretary knew everything that was going on. What all of a sudden made her change for that girl, you know? You know, it just kind of, there were certain things like that, yeah, I get there was. But overall, for this film, I think it's a great film that shows that even if you're, doesn't matter where you are in life, karma does get you. If you do good, good things will come. If you do bad, bad things can come, and which we see in this film. And at the same time, we just got to be aware of our surroundings and remember that work and self-esteem and our own self-awareness is all more important than work. I mean, yeah, that's what I was trying to say. That work is not more important. There's always going to be another job. I always tell them, I tell people at work, they're always like, oh, you do a lot. And I'm like, yeah, but I always tell people my work life is like a foot in water. And they say, well, what does that mean? I said, well, you take the foot out of the water and you're still going to have water. Business is going to keep on going whether I'm there or not.
Yep.
And that's, so if that's the case, what am I going to do with my life? And I kind of see that at the end of this film, and that's why I love it so much, is that finally you see that there's more purpose. You, this guy finally gets it. There's more purpose to life than just a job and getting promoted. So that's kind of my long way, scenic view or scenic route to my final thoughts on this film.
Well, I'm very glad that you're able to articulate way better than I am tonight.
Oh, come on now.
I feel like you got stuck with all the heavy lifting here.
Oh, come on now. You do a great job on this. It, again, I think one of the things, Matt, is you made me think about certain things that I didn't think about. And I'm glad to hear what Amy's thoughts were on this, too, because it, just to get her perspective and getting Elvia's perspective, I always love to hear their point of view and makes me think, well, there's a lot of validity. There's a lot of great points that are made and that we have to take aware, because something maybe I can see, other people don't see. You know what I mean? It's like they see it in a certain way, and it's like, all right, well, that's the greatness of film. You can hate a film or you can love a film. I don't know how many times I've gone to a film with Elvia and she hated it and I loved it, or vice versa.
Yeah. That's something I love about movies too.
Exactly.
It'd be pretty boring if everybody felt the same way. You know?
Yeah.
There's some movies that I feel like, you know, if you're a fan of a genre or just a fan of film in general, like you have to like certain movies. And I never liked that.
No, I agree. I agree 100%.
I will definitely say there are some movies that are considered like some of the greats that I'm not a fan of. And I won't name them because I don't want anybody who listens to turn this off right away.
Yeah, no. But, and I agree. There are films that I cannot stand that are supposedly some of the greatest films out there. But at the same time, there's films that I absolutely love, or you could say they're guilty pleasures or whatever, that, you know, that other people are like, what the heck? This is the dumbest movie. But I think every movie has a way of resonating. And so I think with this film, again, this is why we go through these films, because these are films that I feel like are critical for us to watch. And it just makes you think after you see it.
Yeah.
I mean, think about this. Amy didn't like the film, which is interesting. But what did she go do?
She went and looked up information on the movie. Yeah, it gets you to think.
That's exactly right.
And she wanted to know what it was that people loved about this movie.
Exactly. See? Do you see what I mean?
Yep.
It did exactly what it's supposed to do. For me, I loved the film. And what did I do? I wanted to find out more. I wanted to find out what other movies that some of these characters were in. And so for me, it was a different – it was my – you know, I saw Some Like It Hot, like I said, before I saw this film. But I didn't realize that both of them were done by Billy Wilder till later on. And I was like, holy cow, this guy. And then didn't realize I had already seen Sunset Boulevard, which he had done. Mm-hmm. You know, he did the original Sabrina, which I didn't realize he already had done. I mean, there was just so many things that, you know, he had done that I didn't realize that I already loved, you know, in what he's done. So, I mean, that's what I love about films. I loved it. I explored more, you know. Amy, she didn't like it, but she wanted to know why. And so it makes you think, it makes you go more. And that's what I want films to do. You know, films can be great for just turning your mind off and having a fun time. Like I like to do, sometimes I like to watch The Fast and Furious because I love cars and I love explosions. And am I thinking about the film after I saw it? No.
Some days I'll want to watch, The Godfather. The next day I'm watching, I already used Wrath of the Titans last time. I'm not going to use that again.
It's all right.
Alita Battle Angel.
There you go. Alita Battle Angel. That's right. I do have to correct one thing, though, which is kind of interesting. So earlier I realized that I said Billy Wilder did Ben-Hur and he didn't. That was William Wyler.
Okay. When you said that, I was like, oh, what did Billy Wilder do on Ben-Hur? I was wondering if he wrote it.
But... No, I got him and William Wyler mixed up. I mean, come on, William Wyler, Billy. I mean, it's almost the same name.
It's pretty much the same name.
I mean, that must have been a great time. I mean, I would have. I guess I need to, whoops, sorry, drop something. But yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of funny that I got that. So I apologize for those. I do admit when I'm wrong.
Yes.
So.
It's the best thing you can do on a podcast.
Because I am wrong. What they do say that a broken clock is right twice a day. That's what I tell my wife. She goes, yeah, when you're asleep in the morning and in the evening. I'm like, great, thanks, honey. So
that's love.
That's love. That's exactly right. And I do agree she is the better half. Today we are going over number 95, the movie Fargo, which came out in 1996.
What about the other fella?
He was a little older. You know, he looked like the Marlboro Man.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. But maybe I'm saying that, you know, because he smoked a lot of Marlboros.
Uh-huh.
You know, like a subconscious type of thing.
Oh, yeah, that can happen.
Yeah. Hey, they said they were going to the Twin Cities.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, is that useful to you?
Oh, you betcha, yeah.
Yeah.
The film is about a car salesman who decided to have his wife kidnapped in order to receive ransom money so he could buy a parking lot. And you think that's just a basic plot, but as a Coen film, you know that is only the tip of an iceberg when we go into this incredible movie called Fargo.
It sounds like a Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, it's amazing to see that you take a film basically of a guy who didn't really think it through and to try to get money off of his father-in-law, who is presumably just wealthy, and just whenever you go do bad things will always come back at you.
Absolutely. So, and that seems to be an overarching theme in the movie.
Yeah, very much so. However, I'll tell you, seeing this film, it's funny because you have your base, right? But one of the things I love about Coen Brother film, the Coen Brothers, is that they always add to it. I mean, you look at Raising Arizona, even to the most recent film. I mean, the one that they did on Netflix. I mean, they always add flavor and different types of creativity that into the film that make it just even more entertaining. I mean, here in Fargo, you have... It's based out of the, even though it was never ironically filmed in Fargo, it was based in Fargo, Minnesota, and all the actors learned an accent called, you know, Minnesota Nice. They learned the mannerisms of people from Minnesota, even though, and I just think it's hilarious because they never filmed in Fargo throughout this whole movie.
Yeah, that's funny, right? Most of it takes place in Brainerd, Minnesota.
Yes.
According to, if you want to believe IMDb, the Coens decided to call it Fargo just because it was a catchier title than Brainerd.
Yeah, that makes sense. And again, as we trust the internet, they called Minnesota the Siberia with family restaurants.
That's kind of what it looks like in the movie.
Yeah.
I've never been.
Neither have I. But I'll tell you, I wonder, and I should have looked this up, but I wonder what, how many people went to Fargo or went to Minnesota because of this movie?
Oh, probably a ton.
I mean, they put the wood chipper. What was I reading about the wood chipper is now in some museum in Minnesota. I mean, let's see here. I have it right here.
Oh, I got the same note.
Okay.
So it's used. All right. So the wood chipper used in this movie is now on display at the Fargo Moorhead Visitor Center. That answers how pop culture was affected.
Yes. Yeah.
On my trivia.
So the thing that I found most interesting was, you know, when we go into what movie critics thought about this film, I found this story where it was during the first screening of the movie, Gene Siskel. And I know try not to only talk about Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, but this is an interesting story. Was the first screening of the movie, Gene Siskel, you know, he leaned over to Roger and said, you know, while they're watching this film, this is why we love movies. And then they actually named this the best movie of 1996.
Oh, yeah, they were crazy about this.
I mean, I just thought that was kind of, a telltale sign of how much this movie, you know, influenced, you know, just not only in pop culture of the influx of people wanting to go see Minnesota and the independent type rage at that time, I guess, because I mean you'd see all the dark comedies that kind of followed it. Even though this isn't really a dark comedy, it kind of falls into that mesk or mix of dark comedy and I don't know. It's like
this is right in the middle of that boom of independent movies in the mid 90s, but like Pulp Fiction and Clerks.
Mm-hmm.
No, yeah. This came out at the perfect time for its sensibilities. This was actually my introduction to the Coen brothers.
Really? Okay. Yeah.
So I didn't see this in theaters. I was 96? I was like 11 or something with this movie.
No, when this came out, I didn't see it in movie. How I got to this film was I first saw Raising Arizona.
And,
I really like these guys. And then I ended up seeing Fargo after. And then I saw their Blood Simple. I saw that, and that one blew me away as well, which was, I guess, their first film they did together.
Yeah. I know that, they worked a lot with Sam Raimi throughout the 80s and I think some of the 90s.
Oh, okay.
We'll get back into that later when we get to Francis McDormand.
Yes. So, I don't know. I was just looking at just the various, what did critics say at that time? I mean, it got critical review. I mean, it won a lot of awards when it came to, I mean, this is before Oscars. I'm talking about just the Cannies and... I mean, it just was really highly recognized. It was a very embraced film when it came out. In fact, one of the things I thought was interesting was, and you know it's a good film. I know we're not going back to The Simpsons because I actually don't know. I know, I'm sure there is a Simpsons episode with this.
There's got to be.
Yeah, there has to be. But the other thing was that I found was, so when Fargo premiered in the Cannes, in 96, Joe Coen won for Best Director, and also the movie was also nominated right there. I mean, from the get-go, you know, and usually the Cannes and a lot of those film festivals, it's before the big release. So, I mean, it was already getting critically acclaimed. And then in 2006, this is what I was looking for, it said in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Commerce, this movie was selected culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. So only of six films designated for its first year of eligibility. And so I thought that was really interesting. I mean, it's already into the National Film Registry on its first year. And that's huge.
That's pretty impressive. Yeah. I remember always enjoying this movie, even from... So I think my dad rented this after it came out, you know, on VHS back in the day, and I watched it at home. And I remember liking it even from a younger age just because of the quirkiness of it.
Yeah.
And this is actually, recently was the first time I'd watched it as an adult. And there is so much beneath the surface of this movie that I never would have gotten as a kid.
Oh, I agree. 100%. There's one part of the film that really just haunts me, though. It's at the ending, and without giving too much away, with William H. Macy's character getting pulled.
Ooh, out. Yeah.
Scream. That haunted me when I was younger when I saw it, and it haunted me the last, when I just watched it a week ago. It just, the movie, it haunted me just to scream because you knew the guilt, what the heck did I do to myself? You know,
I think William H. Macy is an awesome actor in general, but I think this movie is his best performance that I've seen.
Oh, 100%. 100%. What's interesting about this film, though, is it had a budget of $7 million. So it wasn't a really big budget, especially even at that time. But it ended up making domestically $24 million and foreign $36
million. Wow.
So $60 million overall. I thought that's so they made a good... They made some good money there. But at the same time, when you see that, you know that it's because people enjoyed it and want to go back and back again. And that's also not with inflation, you know.
I didn't realize how modest this thing was at the beginning. Sorry for interrupting.
No, it's all right.
It's like you mentioned how much it made. And this started off in just the festival circuit. Like it was getting limited releases.
Yeah.
Until people started catching on, and then it really blew up.
And I was just looking at it. I mean, if you, there's an adjuster that I found. And so, yeah, it would have been a, yeah, that's about right. You know, made some really good money.
Upon watching it again recently, just the opening shots with the score playing. So I listen to a lot of film music. I think we talked about that in a previous episode of the podcast. But I am crazy about the soundtrack of this movie. It is that opening theme. As soon as the credits ended, I paused the movie and went to YouTube and listened to the theme song again.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's great. It's so the music was by Carter Burwell. I looked into him, and he is best known for, of all things, scoring Twilight.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He's done tons of movies, but that's kind of like his, you know, I guess that's his most well-known work. So I was pretty shocked to find that. Good score.
Looks like he's done some other Coen brother films too. Like,
yeah,
you know, and so that's pretty cool that, but yeah, I mean, hey, you know, that's cool that he did a Twilight. I mean, it's, you know, at least he got something into pop culture. I mean, like in that
that's
way.
Right. But,
so
yeah, I was kind of surprised to find that this wasn't nominated for best soundtrack the year that it came out.
Yeah. So it looks like it was nominated for 7 categories. It won for screenplay to the Coen brothers, and Frances McDormand, we can talk about because she won for best actress at that time as well.
Yeah.
It was nominated for best picture, best supporting actor, William H. Macy, director. The other was Joel Coen, because at that time, I believe you could only have one director, that you couldn't have the duos like you have now. Cinematography, and then film editing. So,
oh yeah, it was shot by Roger Deakins, the most popular living cinematographer.
Yeah,
he's done tons of movies. Shawshank Redemption, if I'm remembering right.
Mm-hmm.
He's done tons. Also, another Coen Brothers movie, No Country for Old Men. I think he also shot Big Lebowski.
But you're right. I mean, one of the interesting facts that I found on this film, by the way, was that it looks like, I wanted to see what films it was up against. Okay, so the Oscar nominees that year was Shine,
okay,
Jerry Maguire, The English Patient,
oh,
Secrets and Lies, and Fargo.
It was The English Patient that won, right?
It was The English Patient that won. And to me, I look at the list of 5 movies that were nominated that year. Fargo, to me, and I would put Jerry Maguire in there. Those are the 2 movies out of those 5 that, to me, are still watchable today. I mean,
oh, definitely. I've never been able to finish The English Patient. I got bored. Yeah. There's a whole joke about that in Seinfeld.
Yes.
Elaine tries to get through The English Patient with her boss, and she just can't do it.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So, yeah, so Frances McDormand, what did you think about her?
I thought she was amazing. You know, anything she's in, I don't think I've ever seen her give a bad performance. But I just think she's so charming in this movie.
I loved her and her husband in the film. Because
that's right. I wanted to give a shout out to that actor specifically, because John Carroll Lynch.
Yes.
He was also in tons of movies at that time.
Yes. And he played a great character. I guess the Coen, and again, this is to internet research, they say that they actually used a friend who did submit art in for stamps, and so that was a friend of the Coen brothers who was actual their artwork that was submitted in for a stamp contest.
Oh, very cool.
But man, you know, when I saw John Carroll Lynch in this film, normally when I see him, he's kind of like the bad guy, or the guy he's always like the guy who's kind of a jerk.
Almost always.
And so when I saw him in this film, it was not, and maybe it's because we're kind of going backwards and seeing him, but wow. I mean, definitely give him a shout out for his just acting as the supporting husband. I just haven't seen anybody, how he pulled that off. I thought it was great. It just made me laugh.
Yeah, the scenes with him and Frances McDormand together are like a breath of fresh air in this movie, because of how unsleazy and selfish they are compared to pretty much everybody else in the movie.
Exactly. I mean, like the part where she goes and meets up with the guy. I think it's played by Steve Park.
Yeah.
And he's trying to hit on Isa. She's like, okay, I gotta go. You
know, and he starts crying.
Yeah.
That was an uncomfortable scene.
Mike. Oh. Yeah, his name was Mike. And that was pretty funny.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That's
funny.
So I was thinking about it earlier, and, you know, I've always associated with, like, Coen Brothers' humor with, like, you know, it's like scenes that just seem to come out of nowhere and have nothing to do with the rest of the movie. And as I'm observing them now, I'm realizing, like, a lot of these scenes tie into, like, the overall themes of each movie that they put them in. So it's like I start paying more and more attention to these scenes that kind of stand out.
Okay.
Like that one with meeting Mike. I don't know what that one's about. But it got me thinking of other scenes, like her, Frances McDormand, what's her husband's name? Oh, Norm. When Norm visits Marge at the station to bring her lunch.
Yes. And she brings him Nightcrawlers. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And just talking about the painting. And then that ties into, without giving too much away, it's brought up again during the final scene of the movie.
Yeah.
And it's just, you see, like, any scene like that with two characters interacting, and you're like, well, what do that have to do with anything? It always comes back somehow later in the movie with each of these character interactions. Yeah. And it says something about those people and how they end up getting what they deserve in the end.
That's exactly right. And I think that really is the premise of this film. You reap what you sow.
Yep. It's a morality tale.
It is a morality tale. I mean, you think about all, even Steve Buscemi, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. I've heard it both ways.
Yeah, I've always called him Buscemi.
Steve Buscemi. I mean, his character definitely got what, you know, his morality and what he was going to get. And we won't go into that, but it just, you see the characters. And if you go through the list from William H. Macy to Peter Stormare, who played an awesome Swedish bad guy.
Okay. Okay, so Peter Stormare, this was kind of his big break in the States. I always felt like he has this weird presence to him anytime he's in a movie.
Yes.
And I can never quite tell what voice he's going for, because I know he's Swedish, but every character he plays, it's like he's trying to do some different accent, and I can never quite... I can't get my finger on it. It's just, he makes me so uncomfortable.
But that's why he was so perfect for this film.
Exactly. I was like, what voice is it? Is it... Is this an American accent or is this something else? he's so strange. And I think he's great. I actually love seeing him pop up in movies.
The other thing that I really enjoyed was the way they were using the Minnesota nice language, right? Yep. So, you know, you had the hookers, right? This is the part that always made me laugh, was they're asking for a description of the guys they're looking for without giving anything away. And they're saying, well, they're funny looking. They're like, well, can you explain? Well, they're funny looking. And then you hear that again. And the person was like, what the heck are you talking about? Like, they couldn't get anything more than out of them. And then if you notice later on in the film, when the state trooper goes up and asks the guy, like, well, what did you see? And, well, he was a funny looking guy. And they're like, oh, okay. Like, they totally knew what he was talking about. It's like saying, I am Groot. And they understand the Groot language, but in Minnesota, about. Groot language.
Oh, I loved it. Everybody's so, so nice. It's such a polite place.
Exactly. Oh, man.
So speaking of Frances McDormand, I don't remember if we talked about this at some point in the past, but the Coen brothers, which Coen's married to her? Is it Joel or Ethan? I know that at some point before, you know, they all made their big breaks, the Coen brothers, Frances McDormand, Bruce Campbell, and Sam Raimi were all roommates together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And one of the Coens actually edited the original Evil Dead.
It was Joel Coen that was married.
Oh, okay. And actually, as a shout out to their roots, at some point in the movie, Peter Stormare, because... You know, the two con men are hiding out at a cabin, and he's watching a soap opera, and he's getting very invested in what he's watching. The guy in the soap opera is Bruce Campbell.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh,
I guess they do these things for each other in, like, a ton of movies.
Oh, that's
funny. Always be these subtle little hints.
But her, yeah, it was interesting to see how Frances, I mean, I guess she at first was kind of hesitant about doing the whole pregnant thing, but then realized that, you know, the more and more she got into it, the more and more she was really enjoyed the character getting into the character.
Yeah.
So I guess one of the things that I didn't know, and I want to throw this interesting tidbit out that I found out about the film, and was that it was like the second warmest winter in like 100 years. And so when they were filming outside, they had to move all over Minnesota to Canada to North Dakota because there wasn't enough snow. So they actually had to use a lot of artificial snow in the filming.
Ah, okay. Well, they did a really good job.
Yeah, I thought so too.
It looks freezing.
But it did. It was cold, though. There was times because I guess her pregnancy thing that she, you know, I don't know what you call those things that they wear. Actually, she left it in, I guess, her trailer overnight. And when she went on set the next day, it actually exploded.
Oh, wow.
Because it was frozen. So I thought that was kind of... I could have, surprised that didn't make the movie. But anyways, I digress.
So I think the scene that always stuck out to me over the years when I thought about this movie was the kidnapping scene. And how everybody is so inept in this movie, except for maybe Frances McDormand.
Yes.
Like, the two burglars, or the two con men, are they're not subtle at all.
No.
Their attempts to kidnap Jerry's wife.
Yeah.
And she's not subtle at all in her attempts to escape their captor. Like, the whole thing's a mess.
Well, I just thought it was funny because it was like, yeah, it was just, there was no subtleness of it. It was no giving up in the whole thing. Yep. So, I mean, it was, you're right. It was, that's one of the things I really enjoyed about this film was nothing was, everybody was all in. It was go mode from the beginning to the end of this film. And that's yep. One thing I did notice. And the only person who stood back and kind of observed, made her assessment was, you know, Frances McDormand's character, which I thought was, that's what made her so unique and so, I mean, made the film kind of like, she was kind of like the foundation of this film, so that everybody else could be acting crazy. Even the father-in-law of Jerry, I mean.
Oh, yeah, that guy's nuts.
Oh, yeah.
He's intense.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand him.
Guffston. I can't pronounce it. Guffston. I'm not gonna even try.
I think one of the most like not cringy, but like kind of heartbreaking aspects of the movie is how much people walk all over Jerry.
Yes.
William H. Macy's character, and you can see that everybody in his life takes advantage of him.
Yep.
Like, even his son, like, has no respect for him as a human being. And you're just waiting for him to blow up the whole movie.
And it's interesting because there's a part in that film where it feels like he almost relieves all that angst on the people that he sells cars to.
Yeah.
That's where he expresses his aggression. Because there's a scene in there where he's trying to sell this extra coat and everything. And he's like, well, I got to ask the manager. And then he's the manager. And of course, he walks out. He just asks what's going on, I think, on the game or something, and then he comes back in and says,
ugh.
I mean, you can just see the slime baldness of the used car salesman, you know, mentality. It always makes me almost have a twitch because I've had, you know, same situations where you've got car salesmen just trying to, you know, I've had them try to sell me a car, remember, for $15,000. And if it wasn't for my wife that we walked away, then the next morning I looked it up on the internet, and the internet sale for the car was $7,000.
Wow.
And when they called me if we wanted it, I was beside myself that they're like, oh, well, if you get on the internet, this is what it is. Well, isn't that the same thing? Because I could tell you the internet price. Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I could never go back ever again to that dealership. I mean, I just felt like I almost got robbed.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That was.
I could never do that job.
Yeah. So, I mean, when I saw that, I mean, sometimes it just gave me chills, like, man, this is where they come and just want to, like, stick it to everybody else because their life is just falling apart and he's being manipulated and used. I mean, he almost loses that whole, you know, awesome deal that he found, you know, and from his own father-in-law. I mean, that part, I mean, you start seeing how he's being used.
You can see how a guy like this would turn to crime in his desperation. It's because he's at such like a low level of rock bottom
yes.
from the get-go in this movie. And then he's getting into a world that he's he just can't quite maneuver himself around. And it's just, he keeps making the situation worse and worse for himself. But that goes for almost everybody in the movie, including the con men, who makes some mistakes early on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wondered if this film could be renamed Karma. The good things you do, the good things come out. The morality, like you said before, that's the morality. So what did you think about, did this movie influence other pop culture, do you think? Or
so as far as pop culture, the wood chipper in the museum was my only note. I do have some movies that relate to this one, though. So what do you have as far as pop culture?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I saw, I mean, I know, like, you know, movies like this was like Pulp Fiction, which was earlier than this film, even like Do the Right Thing. But what I think the biggest pop culture was actually it opened up the doors to the Coen brother movies and it allowed them to make movies like this more and more. I think that's where I found the pop culture. It opened up kind of more of the dark comedy type films that we could watch. I mean, I really think that it allowed us to see like across the lines with not just being in a crime movie or a gangster movie or a thriller. You can cross the lines, you know, and see other films that you can add into it. And it allowed the studios to take more chances on films like this. I mean, I guess like this year, not trying to age ourselves on this podcast, but, you know, a good film that's out there is called Peanut Butter Falcon. Is like one that, you know, took almost 10 years to be made, but now it's like one of the best films out there. So,
okay, I've heard good things, but I knew almost nothing about the movie.
Yeah. And so I think that that's one of the things I think that this film has influenced is that, yeah, you can take chances on films that are black comedies, more of like even an Americana type film. It doesn't have to be a film specifically of, you know, that fits into the studio mold.
Yeah, I think without movies like this paving the way, you wouldn't have movies like, say, Martin McDonagh's In Bruges. You ever see that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like it's got a pretty similar brand of dark humor, but then it's also got suspense elements. It's sort of a thriller comedy.
Yeah.
Very dark comedy. But yeah, I was thinking about In Bruges a lot while I was watching Fargo.
Okay. Thinking,
wow, this Fargo must have paved the way for a lot of these kind of movies. And like you were saying, like, I think people who like this movie, if this is somebody's first Coen Brothers movie, then they're probably going to get as much entertainment from The Big Lebowski or their version of True Grit or Raising Arizona. But yeah, I think fans of Tarantino would like this.
Yes. It just opens up, I think, up the door too of just, again, you know, and the one thing that I like that the Coen Brothers do well, and I'm gonna kind of go back to what you said earlier, is they bring good people around them. So, and what I mean by that is, you know, not only do they have good actors, I mean, they do the writing, they do the directing together, you know, they do their own editing, but, you know, like you said, they brought one of the best, I think, directors of photography, Roger Deakins.
Yeah,
you know, I think, you know, into it. My favorite film that he did actually was the most recent one, which was Blade Runner 2049.
Oh, yeah. I think he finally won an Oscar for that one.
He did. He deserved it for many, many years. I think the other one that I really like he did was The Assassination of Jesse James.
Oh, that's by the right.
Coward Robert Ford.
Yeah, that was a very gorgeously shot movie.
There's a scene in there when the train's coming up and you just see the light on the shadow of the, on Brad Pitt. And you're just like, oh, I mean, it's just gorgeous. I mean, you just see all the things. I mean, for our listeners out there, if you want to see beautifully shot films, IMDb, Roger Deakins, and just go through and see the films that he's done. And you're going to be just dumbfounded. Even the simple films like Doubt. That movie, to me, you know, just it's a simple film that's kind of in a Catholic kind of like school. And yet it's still beautifully shot and how it tells the story. I mean, all the Coen brother films almost I was trying, you know, to even Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is one of my favorite movies that the Coen brothers have done. So,
yeah, chances are, if you love movies, you know at least one iconic shot that Roger Deakins has done himself.
Yeah.
Like Andy Dufresne in The Rain and Shawshank Redemption. Or
yeah.
He's like the John Williams of cinematography.
That's, I don't think you could have, you can't say it better than that. So true.
So that got me thinking, speaking of Roger Deakins, so I had a note that just said, this movie might be Steve Buscemi at his Buscemiest. Like, just, he is unhinged Steve Buscemi in this movie. But they got me thinking, like, it's everybody in this movie is at, like, the top of their game. It's, like, between him and Frances McDormand. I don't know if this is Frances McDormand's best performance, but it definitely earned that Oscar. And I think even as far as the Coen brothers go, with this movie, you got a good mix of everything that they would go on to do best. It has that kind of signature sense of humor of theirs, but it also showcases how well they can do suspense. And unless you see that these are the guys that would later go on to make No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Like the scenes with William H. Macy being on the edge of being caught. It's kind of on the edge of my seat.
Yeah. I don't know. And I agree with you. I mean, this is the movie that sold me on the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
In all reality.
Because it has the serious elements that they do really well in this, and also has the very comedic stuff that they do really well. I think this movie is like that perfect balance for them.
Yeah. You know, going back to Frances McDormand, I really do believe this is, for me, this is my favorite film that she's done. I mean, I loved her when she was in Almost Famous, and Moonrise Kingdom she was really good in.
Oh, that's right.
I think one of her other better films was Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. But to me, this movie for me was iconic and for her. And so I think if you're looking at like some of the best acting performances a lot of these actors that are in this film has done, I would put a lot of these, this has got to be in their top one or two films that they've done. Buscemi, I'm trying to think of, you know, with him, I mean, he's good in so much.
Yeah.
You know, he was, this one, it feels like he just forgot to take his.
He's so on edge the whole movie.
Yeah, he is unhinged. It's like, I don't want to be in Minnesota. I want to get out. And it's funny because you actually almost believe that that's really what is going on in that guy's head. He does so well.
The thing in this movie that cracks me up is, you know, him and Peter Stormare as the two con men.
Yeah.
How they're complete opposites in personality. Steve Buscemi just never stops talking. Peter Stormare is very quiet. He's very possibly a sociopath.
Yes.
And it's like, these guys clearly can't stand each other. I want to know how they even got started working together. Like, there's no way that these two could ever have gotten along.
That was one of the questions that I wrote down was, how did these two got together? Are they working in like some type of network and they were called together to go work together? I was curious. I mean, I love that one line, that one part where they were talking in the car. Well, Steve Buscemi was talking in the car, and then he said, fine, if you're not going to talk about me, I'm not going to talk to you. I can do this too. And then it's like quiet for like 30 seconds, and all of a sudden he starts talking, saying he just can't shut up.
Oh, loved it. Yeah, any scene that the two of them had together, I loved. Oh, that's the suspense scene I was thinking of that I was like, come on. It was when they're trying to hide a body on the road at night when they see a car coming from the distance.
Oh, yeah. Loved that. That's right.
I think this is easily Peter Stormare's best role.
I agree.
He wanted to do tons of stuff, but I don't think anything was quite of the caliber that this was. It was kind of like a precursor for the character of Chigurh in No Country.
That's true. That is very true. Kind of
quiet, kind of psychopathic,
almost opportunist. And the same type of
weird hair.
Yeah, I mean, just everything. It's kind of spooky when you say that, because it's true. I think that they do share the similar qualities, that except I don't think the guy from No Country for Old Men would have, you know, I think he would have axed Buscemi's character in the car at the beginning of the film.
Oh, yeah. He would not have tolerated him as long as Stormare did.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have.
The Marlboro Man.
So the Paul Bunyan statue that's at the town line.
Yes.
In real life, that's not there.
Yeah, that's in some, like, I guess there's a park that's nearby.
Yeah.
That's where it's at. So that's one of the things that I found that was really interesting was, you know, they shot this film so well that you believe that all that stuff is really there.
Yeah, definitely. I know a lot of people in Minnesota were not fans of this movie. They thought they thought it was making fun of them.
Oh.
So I found a recent review for this movie, a retrospective review from the website IndieWire.
Okay.
This article was a retrospective review of every Coen Brothers movie up till 2013. And the writer of the article is actually from Minnesota. And they had this to say about Fargo. So it says Fargo does take place in Minnesota, where this writer is originally from, and even angered and offended many from the state who thought that they were being made fun of. We Minnesotans do have thick accents and prefer a nice passive-aggressive approach to confrontation, but here it's used to create a unique and oddball world in which to set a darkly comical crime tale. It's hard to be offended by a film this great. A+.
Wow.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the one thing that I think with films in general, I really feel like sometimes you have to see the people who are bringing the film, what is their reasoning for it? What's their background? I mean, you look at the Coen Brothers films, you know that it's going to be a little bit more quirkier than, it's not going to be straightforward. You know, they're going to add their own flavor to it. You know, you see Alfonso Cuarón, see his films. I mean, there is a lot of influence from, you know, of the Latino culture in these films. Even in Gravity, you see, I know you're out of space, but you see the culture that into it. I mean, just, it's amazing. You see the type of, I mean, that's one of the things I think that's important with films. If you really want to get in a deep dive of films, you need to study humanities and look at the lot of these directors and writers, where are they from and how they came up with these scripts. You're going to notice a lot of similarities when in their movies, which that's one of the things I love about it. You know, you see a lot of, you know, so.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh. Yeah, I tried to find some negative reviews to see if I could find any. And there's only two that I could find. One was from Deep Focus. It said if Fargo could make up its mind what kind of movie it wanted to be, it might find meaning in its tangle of surface creatures and impeccable technical stylists. And I'm like, you didn't watch the film.
Yeah, I feel like it knew exactly what it wanted to be.
That's exactly right. They didn't watch the film. The only other one I thought was funny is from the Independent UK. It says, in effect, the Coens have written an action film that disregards the basic principle of the genre, that character is expressed in action. And when I read that, and that's actually a recent review that was done in 2017.
Oh.
Like, that guy obviously went to film school, said, you got to follow the book. And he forgets what storytelling is all about. Which he's going to miss a lot of. I feel like it's a snobbery of some guy who wants to be different, like a hot take on this film. It makes them look like a total idiot. And yes, I just don't think, okay, you might want to take that out. But,
every movie is going to have a negative review from some professional critic. Like anything will.
Oh,
I think, what's it? Leonard Maltin. People can take or leave The Dark Knight, but most people seem to love it. Most critics agree. Leonard Maltin gave it, I think, 1.5 or 2 stars. Something really low like that. And he basically said it was a joyless slog.
I think the only
you're always going to find somebody.
Yeah. And I just find that I think sometimes it's like, do you gravitate the film? Do you not? And so it's amazing when you find those. I always wonder, though, like, and this is a question that I have to critics, and I'd love to hear from you. Are there films that you just don't like regardless of what it, or is there sometimes an attention getting, I guess I'll never get this answer, but sometimes I wonder, do people say something negative because they want that attention of, you know, that there's one person who doesn't like it, or they want to be in the minority of it. I don't know. I'm just, it's one of those questions that I always have about when I read reviews. You know, why do certain people think one way versus the majority? You know, I've always was curious about that.
Yeah.
So
Even among us, like, I'm sure there are some movies that are considered the greats that you probably don't enjoy yourself.
That is very true. But it's just interesting. I think it's just, at the end of the day, that's what I love about film, is do we want to, what does it say to us? Do we like it? Do we hate it? I think there is a film that I was, that we will be reviewing, I won't say what it is, that I'm hesitant to see it again, because I don't like the film, but it's really, really well done, and we'll talk about it when we get to it.
Ooh, I'm excited to hear what that's going to be.
But at the same time, I have to acknowledge what the message is, what it brings. And so I think that we get that from some of the critics out there. So we should scratch out the thing about calling an idiot, because they're not an idiot. That's just bad grammar on my part.
Oh, but good.
What I mean is, the one thing is, like, I remember my wife and I, we went and saw a film, and I can't remember what one we saw, but we talked about the film for like over an hour after. And I looked at her and I said, this is why this movie is so good. And she's like, well, why? I said, because you don't like it, but you talked about it and we had a conversation about it.
Yeah.
And she's like, she didn't think about it like that before. I won't say what film it is either, actually, now that I remember, because I really liked it and my wife would kill me if I said what one it was.
Oh, boy.
I'll tell you off air. But it just, like, we had a great long conversation about the movie and it opened up her eyes, like the different perspective of me. And that's what I love about films. Does it open it up? And so the film that we will talk about that I don't like, but I think it's one of the best films that is out there. We're definitely gonna, you know, I'll definitely be talking. Yeah. It's a huge, and it made a huge effect in pop culture. So, but we will get to that.
You can definitely respect a movie for its craft and storytelling without actually enjoying the experience of watching that movie.
Exactly.
There's a few of them out there for me. Fargo's not one of them. I'm so glad that you added Fargo to your list, because watching it again, I may not have ever watched it again on my own, and I absolutely loved it.
So you come up to another thing that I just thought about was, so you talked about when you saw Fargo the first time was probably when you're a lot younger, and now you saw it now as an adult. Isn't it funny how there's movies out there that you see when you're younger that were really good or you didn't like, and then you see as an adult and you're like, holy cow, this is, you get a totally different perspective.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I see films all the time and I'm like that. And I'm like, holy cow, like, what was on TV the other day? I saw Ferris Bueller Day Off again. And now I resonate more with Cameron than I did with Ferris. In fact, I kind of had a less of respect for Ferris and more respect for Cameron. Yes.
Oh, yeah. So I was just thinking about Ferris Bueller the other day because I've been getting through Deadwood.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey Jones is in that, and he was the principal in Ferris Bueller. I was like,
yes.
Do I kind of side with the principal in Ferris Bueller's Day Off? I was like, oh, yeah. No, I'm an adult.
I know. You kind of go through those progressions, because then I'm like, man, though, I don't know if I would take off the rest of this day of school to hunt this guy down. I don't know if I'd waste my time. But
yeah.
At the same time, you start understanding, like, hey, this guy's breaking the rules, you know, and getting away with it.
Yep. So, this man's very passionate about his job.
And at the same time, when I was younger, I was like, you know, Ferris all the way, you know?
Oh, yeah. Same here. I love Cameron. I think he's one of the funniest 80s movie characters ever.
Agreed. 100%.
When Cameron came to Egypt land.
What was it? Let my camels go.
Let my Cameron go.
Let my Cameron go. So, do you think this film is rewatchable?
Absolutely. I loved it more this time through than any other viewing I've had. I'd seen it a few times in the past. But, you know, when I was younger, I was like, oh, you know, funny dialogue. But now I'm seeing the movie for what it is and the moral themes of it. And I don't know, it's just great. It's just, this is one of those movies that fires on all cylinders for me.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
I think watching it again, you know, I've seen this film every couple of years. Like, I'll probably see it like every 3 or 4 years. And seeing it now, being older, I really have more appreciation for the film than I did before. And I feel like I could watch it more and more now than I could. I mean, I will definitely go back to it again. At least, I mean, I want to watch it again just because I really enjoyed the setting. I enjoyed the acting in it, the plot in it, you know, the morality of the film. It just, I really enjoyed all of it. It just was really, it's one that I think anybody, even if you're from Minnesota, to go watch. You know, it's funny. I was thinking about the comment about, you know, some of them were offended, but I remember my wife is from Guatemala, and so I go down to Central America a lot. And one of the things they, in there, if you see their TV shows, they like to make fun of each other. And I'm not saying this movie is making fun of Minnesotans, but I think what they're, what it's saying is have fun with it, embrace it, you know, enjoy that they're spending time up there. It's like, I swear, with my work, I travel a lot. And I talk to people all over the country. And whenever I bring up Washington, what is the first... Let me ask you this. What's the first thing that everybody asks about Seattle area?
Does it rain all the time?
100%. Bingo. And I tell you, it's just... It's what everybody thinks of. So now when you think of Fargo, what are you going to think of? The movie Fargo. You're going to think about this movie. You're going to think about, you know...
Bingo.
The lingo. I mean, it's just, you're adding flavor, you're getting it out there. I mean, what better way to do it than in one of the best films ever made?
Definitely.
One thing that I want to add too is one of the influences that obviously came out that we can't ignore is that it came out with the TV show Fargo.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe that hasn't come up till now. Holy cow.
I know.
Yeah. Have you seen the show?
I will be honest. I have not seen the show.
I got through the first season.
Okay.
It wasn't for me. I felt like it tried very hard to be quirky. I felt like it went out of its way to be weird.
Okay.
And its dialogue. It feels like written dialogue. Maybe it gets better after that point, but you know, I was kind of disappointed by it.
It's got a
great cast.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to see it, because it's got, you know, Billy Bob Thornton. I know it's got Martin Freeman, Colin Hanks, you know, Patrick Wilson is in it, Ewan McGregor, Kristen Dunst. It's got a lot of names in there. I haven't seen it. I know that Ted Danson's in it. I mean, I'm just naming off a ton of them that are in there. But I just honestly, it's the blessing and curse of TV. I'd love to watch it, but I just haven't gotten to it. It's just time.
Yeah, that's the thing I love about movies. You can get a whole story in 2 hours. For TV, you have to make this real commitment to get through seasons worth.
Yes, like, you know, if you're watching this, what, there's 10 episodes in the first season, I think, or 11 episodes or something like that. I mean, that's 11 hours of TV.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't had that much time, you know, especially when you've got kids and, you know, you're trying to figure out, and then work and everything else. So, I mean, that's what I love about movies. At least I get 2 hours, maybe 3 hours, you know, tops. Like, you know, if you want to go see like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood or Endgame, where they're now closer to 3 hour films.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's hard to get through, you know, a season of 11 episodes, and then you got to go into the next season. So I would like to get to it, but I've heard mixed reviews about it. So I don't know if I will yet or not. So, but I know a lot of people that do like it, and you know, so I mean, it did influence a series, a TV series.
If it means anything, the TV series has a higher rating on IMDb than the movie does.
Does it really?
Wow. Yeah, I think it's got something around a 9.0, where the movie has an 8.1.
Okay, interesting. That's interesting.
Right.
But you know, I haven't seen it. I can't say if I like it or not. I know that it's, from what I understand, it's not the same storyline.
No.
Which is good.
Yeah, I'm glad that it wasn't a complete remake of the movie. It's just other stories that happen to take place in that area.
Yeah.
Other allegedly true stories.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Because I was going to say, I hope it's not like Hawaii Five-0, where you feel like every time you see that show, if you do watch that, that there's major crime and cartels and drug sprees going on in Hawaii. where in Fargo, I don't think it, you know, there might be stuff going on, but at least a lot of it's story, which is good. I'm kind of, it's late. It's been a long day.
I hear you. Do you have any final thoughts or thoughts on what the movie can teach us today?
So my final thoughts on the film, I really felt watching this film again today, is I learned that doing what's right, doing what's authentically what you believe in, will always come out better than trying to make a shortcut into what you want. Kind of back to the morality of things. Even, you know, if you look at Frances McDormand's character, she believed in being a cop. She believed in her marriage. She made the best out of it for both, and it turned out well for her at the end. You see what happens with William H. Macy. You see what happens with the other characters. And whoever, you know, whatever way they were trying to go, you see what the brutal reality of it comes out at the end. It kind of reminds me of, you see a lot of different people and you think, oh man, those people are happy, or these people have got it made. In all reality, there's, depending on what the decisions they make in their own lives, we're going to find out, or they're going to find out, the brutal reality of who they are by the, you know, the repercussions of their actions. And that's kind of what I understood from this film. I really understood that in a funny kind of quirky way, that people are, you know, are responsible for their actions. So that's what I got, in a long way of saying that.
We got pretty much the same message from this. I read that the only lead character who isn't punished somehow in attaining their goal in the end is Marge. And that's because she's the only one who doesn't resort to harming others to get what she wants. Even if you look at, like, Jerry's son, our introduction to him is him being dismissive and rude to his parents. And in the end, he's left pretty much mentally scarred.
Yeah.
And Jerry's intentions, while for the greater good, his methods of getting there are obviously the wrong way. While it seems like at times the movie is sort of teasing the Minnesota culture, the only characters that earn happiness in the end are two locals. It's Marge and her husband, Norm.
Yep.
Being non-selfish, caring people. Funny thing about Marge and Norm, every scene that they have together, they're either lying in bed or eating.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I'd read a little bit about other people's analysis of this movie, and there's so much to unpack in Fargo. So, like, I think even just at face value, without reading into the messages and everything, it's still just a really entertaining movie.
Yeah.
But there is so much to think about if you really want to put the thought into this movie. Like, some people say that it's not a happy ending for Marge and Norm, that they look kind of sad in the end, and maybe that's why they're always eating or laying in bed when you see them together.
Well, I'll put here's my analysis on that, being married. And gained a ton of weight being married. We don't eat because it's bad. It's because we really enjoy it. It's our way of us enjoying our company. And maybe that's just my own personal thing. But I tell you what, the best way that me and my wife and I share time together is over a meal. So, I mean, obviously there's other things.
Honestly, same here.
So, I mean, honestly, I that's why I did not see that at all. I did not see that. And I even thought it was interesting because I know the character Mike, who's the guy that calls up Marge because he saw him on TV. I'm like, why is that in the movie, right?
Mm-hmm. That's a scene that I couldn't quite figure out myself.
After talking about this film today, that scene makes perfect sense to me, and I'll tell you why. That whole experience is exactly what the movie's about. He's trying to mask that he lost his wife. You know, he's no longer with his wife. And I can't remember if he said that she died or not. I can't remember. Was it that they divorced or?
Oh, I believe he said that she died.
Yeah, she died. Wanting sympathy, right? He wanted something. And then she finds out later that he made the whole thing up.
Yeah, kind of creepy.
Creepy. But what did we find out? We found out the reality, the true nakedness of Mike. We found out that the purity and the honesty that and the loyalty that, you know, Marge. That Marge had was, you know, to her husband. and the happiness continued on. This is me kind of going a little bit my philosophy on this.
Oh, no, go for it, because I was curious about that scene.
So it kind of, for me, tells the whole story that we're in a microcosm, because we see, without saying the whole other parts of the film, if you try to parallel that with Jerry, right? Jerry is trying to do something, get sympathy, to get what he wants. In all reality, you see the nakedness of the brutal reality of the who Jerry really is at the end of the film, without, you know, and it just reminded me of a lot of Steve's character. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Oh, that makes sense.
And the person who is honest, and the person who discovers it all, the person who sticks to their morals and to their guts, was Marge. And so Marge was in both the macro and the micro of this film. And so I think that was just kind of like a little bit of the story being told, you know, through the whole little story of Mike, if that makes any sense at all. So that's just my thought. Oh. I'm sticking to it. I'll seal and stamp and approve it.
It makes sense to me. That's I hadn't put much thought into that scene, but I was like, okay, well, where does that scene tie into the rest of the movie and Marge's character? So yeah, I'm glad that you explained that.
There's a lot of movies that's funny that I don't catch on to things like that until I see it again and again. And I'm like, oh, aha.
Yeah. I'm one of those people that I know that there's something in the movie and I haven't figured out. I always go online and look up like video essays and things like that.
That's cool.
I'm like, okay, what did I miss? I feel like this movie was telling me something, but I didn't quite catch it.
Well, I think this is what we think of the movie Fargo, which is our film number 95. And we would love to hear what you think about the film. You can find us. You can find me on Instagram at Hans Esky, which is Hans Esky, or on Twitter at H Eskelson, which is Heskelsen. Or you can reach Matt. Matt, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at MHS Reviews. My other podcast is Modern Horror Show, where I'm talking about and recommending some of the better horror movies of the 21st century, or at least I like to think better horror movies.
So what
check me out there.
What kind of horror movie are you doing right now?
So right now I'm actually getting into the adaptation of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, produced by Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
And getting into the history of horror movies that are aimed for a child audience, which isn't something that you get a lot of anymore. Where, say, like in the 80s, you had movies like Monster Squad and
Poltergeist. Little
Monsters, Poltergeist, which still Gremlins. Scares me.
You know, I remember seeing Poltergeist when I was young, and I still get why my parents thought, you know, my mom, and, you know, would, you know, scorn me for movies I'd see. And I'm like, thinking of all the movies you had me watch when I was a kid that scared me to death. And I'm like,
oh, that PG rating tricked a lot of parents into bringing their kids to see Poltergeist.
Yes.
That movie still skeeves me out.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so I'm basically getting into Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark and how it kind of harkens back to the days when movie wasn't afraid to scare some kids.
That's true. That's true.
Yes, it's definitely going to do that.
No, that's awesome. Well, yeah. Well, so check out Matt's podcast. I'll tell you some of the reviews that you've been doing and the dives into horror genre is pretty, pretty entertaining. So definitely check out Matt. So join us next time as we explore another film that should be remembered and should be watched. See you next time.